Exmark makes the mowers that care for the lawns that set the stage for the backyard life. As the commercial mowers more landscape pros trust, Exmark mowers get you on and off the lawn without compromising cut quality, comfort, or reliability. Exmark, official mowers of the backyard life, starting at $29.99. Learn about the available finance offers and check them out today at The Mower Shop, 7400 Preston Highway, Louisville, Kentucky, 502-969-6433.
Make your life better with a new job at UPS. Join Team Louisville as a warehouse worker, earn $14.50 per hour plus a $175 weekly bonus for some shifts. Search and apply now at upsjobs.com/Louisville. That's upsjobs.com/Louisville.
Bet Rivers Sportsbook has supercharged its iOS app. Download the update today from the Apple App Store and see the difference for yourself. Must be 21 or over to play. Playable only in Indiana. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-9-WITH-IT.
Get ready for Sports Talk with Dan Issel and Mike Pratt, right here on ESPN 680 and 105.7. Now here's Dan and Mike.
And welcome back to Sports Talk with Mike Pratt and Dan Issel on ESPN Louisville 680 and 105.7. Michael, what do you got over there?
We got a caller, don't we, Process? Kenny, let's plug him in.
Hey, Kenny.
How are you all today?
We're terrific. How are you?
Good. Really enjoyed your show, the parts I've got to listen to this week, and I think it's going to be a big hit for y'all.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that.
Good. Y'all talking about the Masters coming up, or obviously it's going on. A funny Kentucky Colonel story. When I was a teenager, I worked at Seneca Golf Course, and some of the Colonels came out. I don't know who all... But I know Artis was in there, and I think he had just taken the game up, and it was so funny. We looked over, and he was on number one tee, and he had just a regular length shaft driver out, and it looked like he was bending over to tie his shoelaces. He had to bend over so far to reach the golf ball.
Well, Kenny, that's changed. Artis must have gotten – Artis plays a lot of golf now. He goes to a lot of celebrity golf tournaments around the country. He always comes in – for our golf tournament that benefits the effort to bring the NBA to Louisville, but he must have got a set of customized clubs along the way, because now his driver's about as tall as I am.
Right, I'm sure he does. Yeah. Well, I just wanted to pass that along to y'all.
All right. Thank you for the call. Stay listening.
Thanks, Kenny. I'll tell you a couple A-Train stories, and we both love the guy. So his wife is from south of Charlotte in South Carolina.
Enola.
And so Artis, I'm an assistant coach at Charlotte making like $14,000 or something, $15,000. I don't belong to any country club. But behind the school was a 9-hole goat track that they called a golf course, okay? It was public. And we would go down, and the guy that ran it, can't remember if he owned it. He'd let us play for free, you know. And so I got Everett Bass trying to pick up golf, and we'd go down and play. And, of course, Lee Rose didn't play. But A-Train calls me one time. He says, I'm going to be – this is like 76, 77, some 78 in there. I'm going to be in wherever his wife's from. Boiling Springs, maybe, let's say. And can I come up and let's play some golf? And I didn't know he played. I said, sure, come on, eh? And so he comes. He said, by the way, I'm going to bring my father-in-law. I said, yeah, come on. So I guess he thought I was going to take him to a very nice club, because he's making a lot of money playing. He was with the Bulls at that time,
yeah,
I believe.
That's where he went when the Colonels dispersed. That's where A went, play for Chicago.
We had a ball, but he was not impressed with my golf course. Okay. So now, and his father-in-law was really a neat guy. We played. And so about 80, 81, I get another call from A. Now I'm the head coach, and I belong to a country club. It's not like the best country club.
Now you're making $28,000. Yeah. They've doubled your salary.
Actually, it was $34,000. So I did belong to a club. That was part of my deal. I got a car, and they paid my dues. So it was Pine Lakes. I never been back to that club since I left Charlotte the last time. So I take A out, and I told him, I said, look, I'm bringing this guy out with me, Artis Gilmore. They go, like, Pro goes, no way. I said, yeah, he's coming out. So I said, I just want to tell you, and we're going to, you know, have a good time, and if anybody wants to join us, come on. So I get there early, and I was going to take care of the driving range and get it all set up for A. So I said, do you have anybody that's playing with us? And he goes, no. And I knew all the hustlers out there at the course, you know. Mm-hmm. This guy and that guy, they're not going to play. But they're always there at lunch looking to play cards or go play, you know, 18. I mean, that's part of the process at this club. So A shows up, and we hit a few balls and head to the first tee. And there's the pro shop kind of overlooked the first tee. The first tee was down a little bit, but still it was a view down into the first holes, beautiful trees and all this stuff. So A and I are out there, we're on the tee box, joking around, and I hit my ball, and he goes to the bag and pulls out the driver you're talking about. It was as tall as him.
No, it's literally, it's got to be 6 feet long.
So I look back, and on the patio deck looking down into the first tee, all these guys that I know are hustlers are watching this, okay? So I hit my usual drive out there. I'm okay, and A gets up there, and he snap hooks one. And so I said, hit another ball. So he hits it down the middle. Now, before we could get out of our cart or into our cart, now off the first tee, two of these guys got their bags in their carts, and they're running out to play with us, you know. And I said, hey, you know, don't be betting with these guys. I know who they are, right? But he loves the game.
He loves to play. My best Artis Gilmore story is when we used to play against the Pacers, we'd take a bus to Indianapolis. We wouldn't, unless we, you know, were going on after that to some other city, we'd take a bus to Indianapolis, and Artis was always late. And never on time, always late. So Babe McCarthy was our coach, and the Colonels had a suite of rooms over at the old
Executive Inn.
Yep. And there was, you could look out the windows, and the players would park their cars at the Executive Inn and then get on the bus. Well, Babe would stay in the office and look out that window until Artis finally showed up and got on the bus. And then Babe would come running out of the office, jump on the bus, say, okay, I don't care who's not here. Let's go. Let's take off. But he made sure, even if he was 15, 20 minutes late, he made sure Gilmore was on that bus before he came out of the office.
A lot of coaches do that. A lot of – but I want to get to playing the Pacers. I left an assistant coach one time. When I was coaching Charlotte, one of my assistants, and he was like A, he was always late, but he wasn't as talented. I mean, he was a good guy and talented, but he wasn't Artis Gilmore of the assistant coaches deal. And a nice guy, was a terrific high school coach. He was always late. And so, you know, I left him one time. So we're driving up. We're on our way. I might have been going to play East Carolina or Wake Forest or somebody. We're headed up 95. And all of a sudden, here comes the car that I know is Bob's car. And he's got his wife driving. He's sitting in the passenger seat trying to get the bus driver's attention. So I'm right behind the bus driver in the head coach's seat, you know. And I told the busie, I said, figure out where we can stop here. We got to pick somebody up. And he said, who are we picking up? And I said, that's my assistant coach right over there. His wife is driving him. He was late. He said, we left him? I said, yeah, we left him. You know, he's like, it was 10 minutes past takeoff time. That's all right. All the guys are on, you know.
That's
so
right. I left Louie when the second time I coached the Nuggets. I talked Louie into coming out, and he was the assistant. He was an assistant coach in Denver for the Nuggets for 4 years. And I left Louie one time. Now, it was a hotel We were in Minneapolis. It was a hotel, and it was only about three blocks from the arena. So I knew Louis could walk over there. But like you just said, everybody was on the bus except for Louis. So I left him, and we went over to the Target Center, and we were having shoot around. Finally, here comes Louis walking in with that sheepish grin on his face. I said, what happened? He said, I was going by the clock in the hotel room. I said, Louis, when you check into a hotel, the first thing you do is check that clock and make sure it's right if that's what you're going to go by. He wasn't going by his watch or anything. He was going by the clock in the hotel room. So we never had to leave Louis again after that one.
How about, let's go back. You mentioned playing the Pacers when we were with the Colonels. We played at the arena at the Fairgrounds, right?
Right.
And that was a dump.
I think, wasn't it a roller skating arena when they weren't playing basketball there?
Could have been.
I think it was a roller skating arena. And then they put the floor down for the Pacers to play. But, yeah, it wasn't much.
And the locker room, I think, was kind of like upstairs.
Yeah,
or
you
something.
Walked, yeah. You're exactly right. Yeah. Walked up a flight of steps. Yeah.
But they always had, if I remember right, they'd put a case of beer or two 12 packs or a case. Do you remember that? Do you remember what kind of beer it was?
No.
It was Budweiser.
Was?
But a lot of places would put just, like Falstaff.
Yeah.
And just some beers you probably wouldn't want to drink. Of course, we had a great group of guys that would sit around and have beers and just tell stories. Now guys are out the locker room by themselves and out of the arena.
And smoke cigarettes.
Oh, yeah.
I can remember my rookie year with the Colonels, your rookie year with the Colonels. We had like three guys, Walt Simon, Les Hunter, and maybe Sam Smith. They'd fire one up at halftime.
Well, Goose Ligon,
Goose too. Yeah. Can you imagine today's NBA guys having a cigarette at halftime or having a couple beers before they left the locker room to go home? I mean, that's kind of stuff just would never happen again.
So when you coached Denver, were there any smokers?
No. By then,
that was there all, beer in the locker room?
There was the first time in the early 90s when I coached, there was. But then the second time, by the late 90s, they had taken all of that out of there. Primarily a liability situation, not so much you didn't want the guys to have a beer or something after a game. But, that disappeared around the mid-90s.
So I've got a story about that, too, I was going to tell you. But do you remember we took the bus up, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it was maybe our rookie year. And then we obviously, if you wanted to get something to eat, they had a hamburger place. And I'm going to ask you if you remember what it was, what kind of hamburger place. They pulled the bus over, went in and got hamburgers, and then rode back down to Louisville. It might have been our rookie year. Do you remember what that fast food place was?
It was a White Castle, wasn't it?
No. Burger Chef. Remember Burger Chef? It was right there outside of the arena, outside of the fairgrounds. Okay.
And now the NBA players get on the airplane, and they've got a buffet fit for a king.
Do they really?
Oh, it's unbelievable. The food they – the unbelievable part about it is you get like $150 per diem. Or maybe
that's a little bit more than the 15 we used to get.
Maybe it might be even more than that, Mike. But you never have to spend any of your per diem because they have breakfast for a team meeting. They have meals on the plane. They have buffets in the locker room. So you get to that's all profit. You put that
racetrack money, brother.
You put that $150, $200 in your pocket and never have to take it out.
Oh, back in the early 80s, and stop me if I've told you this story, Steve Yeager and I went to school together, kind of like, you and Kenny Anderson.
Yep.
We weren't neighbors or anything, but we were teammates. Yeager caught for the Dodgers for 10 years. He's in Major League, the first Major League. He's in that. A guy from Dayton, and I didn't know him, but he was in L.A. and produced this movie, the first, the second Major League, too. So he hired Yeager to be an advisor, and Yeager's even in the show from time to time. So we're at Howard Garfinkel's camp, okay, in Pittsburgh, five-star, the Pittsburgh edition. And the Dodgers are coming to town. So I call back, and I'm at the time I'm a head coach, I call back, and I ask our secretary to call the Dodgers, track Yeager down, and yada, yada. So she did her best and called. They said, this is the hotel, and you can call. So I called the hotel, and we're staying in a different hotel, and I left a message for him to call me. He called back. And we really hadn't seen each other in quite a few years. But he called back and left me a message, and we traded. You know, there weren't cell phones then. This is a while ago. We traded phone calls, and he arranged for us being Bobby Kremins, head coach at Appalachian State at the time. I was head coach at Charlotte. And Kevin Cantwell, his longtime assistant, both are New York City guys.
Right.
Okay. And I told him, I said, you want to go see the Dodgers? And you thought I'd said, hey, you want $10,000, you know, cash? They were so excited to go see the Dodgers. And so Yeager said, meet me at, so it's a 2 o'clock game, it's a television game. Yeager said, meet me at 10:30, 11 o'clock at the player's entrance. Okay. All right. So Kremins misses it because he gets sick in the morning. He gets sick and he can't go. So Cantwell goes with me, and we're there at the old Three River Stadium. And we're right at the right time and right place. And before Yeager gets there, in walks Willie Stargell, Dave Parker, and Manny Sanguin. And you got two huge men that could play in the NFL.
Right.
In Parker and
Stargell.
Sanguin's a little bitty guy, skinny little guy. He caught for him. I mean, he was a heck of a catcher, right?
Yeah.
But he was a little guy. He's around these two guys that are about 6'5 and 250. And they're walking in front of us. Of course, you would think that guys would be dressed a little nicer, but they had cutoff shirts and shorts and flip-flops. They were going to work on a Saturday afternoon in Major League Baseball. So Yeager shows up. So we go in right in. He takes us right in. He had it all worked out. And so we're in the locker room, and his locker was next to Garvey's locker. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know Yeager and Garvey didn't get along, but at this point in Pittsburgh, they were side by side. So Cantwell and I pull up a little stool like they have in baseball in the locker room at that time, and we're talking with Yeager, and Dusty Baker goes by, and we get introduced. And so Kevin was sitting in – he had pulled Garvey's little stool. Garvey came up and just stood behind us and stood there and stood there. And I'm going like, what the – you know. And finally, Yeager says, what do you need, Steve? And he goes, I need my chair back. And Kevin – and so – instead of going to get another chair, which they were plentiful, he wanted the chair that Kevin Cantwell was sitting. So we had to give the chair up. So Yeager takes us into meet Tommy Lasorda and the coaches. And they were really gracious. And Lasorda gave me a Dodgers hat for my son. He said, you have a son? Does he play ball? I said, yeah, he plays a little baseball. You know, at that time he was. So I got a Dodgers hat. So we go back to Yeager's little cubicle, and there's a refrigerator, like 10 foot tall. Okay. It's a very large, one of those large skinny ones. The door opens up. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they've got like six levels to it. Thing was packed. Okay. Sodas, milk, chewing tobacco, beer. Okay. And water, whatever. It was just chock full in the visitor's locker room. And guys would go and they would get some chewing tobacco, to get a Coke or something, and water. And so it must have had two cases of beer in there stacked up. So we didn't. Yeager said, whatever you want, just go help yourself. And we go, nah, I think we got a soda. And we went out. We sat in the dugout and all that kind of – it was cool. And so we think that possibly – well, we know we're meeting Yeager afterwards. He said, just come down. We had some kind of identification. And we think, well, we'll just wait and get a beer in there with Steve. So we go back down when they first up, whenever it is they allow you to come in. So we go over where Yeager, they said he just jumped in the shower. So we're standing there, and Kevin goes, let's go get a beer. And I go, yeah, that sounds good. So we go around the corner, and this thing is, it was packed during the first part of the ball game,
right.
You know, the practice part of your ball game. There's nothing in there, nothing. But a couple bags of chewing tobacco. There's no beer. There's no Cokes. There's no nothing. And so I said something to Jaeger. I said, man, we were really looking for a beer. You know, it's hot out there, you know, in Pittsburgh in the middle of July. And he goes, well, you got to get here early because a lot of guys put that in their bag.
Bags, yeah.
Back to the hotel. But this thing was, you know, as tall as Artis Gilmore. You know, this is 7 foot, 8 foot, and was chuck full of stuff.
It was empty.
I didn't know what you had in your life, but chuck full of stuff. It was quite an experience. That major league dugout is in locker room.
So you had to buy your own beer.
Had to go back to where Jaeger was staying and visit with him. And, you know, he's got those alligator arms. I think we ended up buying him a beer.
That's messed up, man.
I know.
Having a friend with alligator arms is the worst thing of all time, man. I hate people like that.
Yeah, I know. You know what? There's a lot of guys have regular arms until the check comes, and then all of a sudden.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, so you got to hang out with Pop Stargell and Dave Partman. That's cool.
Yeah. They we were sitting on the bench, and Jaeger's coach, who was third base coach at the time, I can't think of his name, nice guy, coached all those Dodger guys, Garvey and Say and Jaeger and two or three pitchers up through the leagues. So he coached Albuquerque, coached most of these guys, then moved up to the big club. We sat there and talked to him about basketball. You know, Steve introduced us, and we talked to him about, he wanted to talk about basketball. And this is an interesting aside. Tony Kubek comes by. He's doing the game. So he comes by.
Former Yankee shortstop.
I think he's from Wisconsin, too. So he stops to see the coach, and I can see him right now. Legendary minor league coach, third base coach for the Dodgers. Kubik sits down and starts talking. What do you do? How are you here? He's trying to figure out how are we in the dugout, you know, half an hour before the ball game or whatever it is. And so we tell him, and we start talking. He wants to talk basketball, okay? And then he finds out, you know, that I had played at Kentucky, played in the Colonels, and Kevin was coaching and had played at a small school in North Carolina. He wanted to talk hoops. He was a big hoops guy. So I don't know. I guess he had done all his prep, Dan.
So he was ready for the game.
He was ready for the game. And we had a great time. And because being the Yankee shortstop, it was pretty cool for me to meet him.
Absolutely.
That was really cool. Was really cool. Yeah, but I'm going to tell you what, Stargell and Parker – big men.
6'5". And could hit the baseball a long, long way.
And had, you know, they looked like weightlifters with these arms. I mean, they were huge.
Which was unusual. I mean, a lot of them look like weightlifters today. But at that time, the people, athletes, weren't really into weightlifting like they are today.
No, there weren't any weight room.
Yeah.
Rooms in the bottom of Three Rivers Stadium.
Right, yeah. I hired the very first strength and conditioning coach in the NBA, and that would have been early 90s. Up until that time, there was no such thing as a strength and conditioning coach in basketball. Everybody thought if you lifted weights, it would affect your shot and things like that. And of course, now every team has like three of them.
Well, I see what you think. I think when Jordan said, I'm lifting, when Michael Jordan said, I'm lifting,
then
I think it turned around.
Everybody. And you know what? The players love it. They love these guys, and they love doing it. When I was coaching the Nuggets, if I said, okay, guys, we're going to spend the next hour on, and we can either do it on the practice floor or we can do it in the weight room, 90% of them would be in the weight room.
Really?
Oh, unbelievable. Unbelievable. Wow.
We had with the original Charlotte Hornets, we had a guy that was really good, too. Chip was outstanding. The guys loved him. And Muggsy Bogues was a big lifter. Muggsy would go in there and lift. We had quite a few guys. Not a lot. Not all of them. Okay.
Yeah.
But we were an expansion team too. We had guys at the end of their careers were picked up in the expansion draft,
just trying to pull one more year out of it.
One more year out of it, and so that's it. I didn't know that you had
the very first
forerunner in weightlifting.
Well, and it wasn't my idea; it was the owner's idea. the owner of the team had Steve as his personal trainer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so he said, he calls me up and he says, I want you to interview this guy. I want to hire him for the team. And like I said, nobody had a strength and conditioning coach. So he comes in and we talk and said, you know, this sounds like a good idea. Let's start at $50,000 a year. And he said, oh, no, the owner told me I'd get $100,000.
Really? Six figures.
So we hired him as our strength and conditioning coach, making $100,000 a year. But he was terrific. I mean, the guys loved him, and he got him to work awfully hard.
The job then would be to be his assistant at $60,000. Right?
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
Well, we're going to take a break, but I want to come back. One of the texters or somebody didn't leave a name, but a texter asked if we had played with or against Pete Maravich. And I know we have some Pete Maravich stories.
Yeah.
That'll be fun. Process, we'll take a break. This is Sports Talk, Mike Pratt, Dan Issel, ESPN Louisville, 680 1057.
You're locked on Sports Talk with Dan Issel and Mike Pratt, right here on ESPN 680 and 1057. Now here's Dan and Mike.
I guess since we have that professional introduce us, we don't have to come back and say this is Sports Talk with Mike Pratt and Dan Issel.
Well, we always can. We're trying to help our brand, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Well, welcome back to Sports Talk with Mike Pratt and Dan Issel on ESPN Lou 680 and 105.7. Michael, what did our texter have to ask over there?
He wanted to know if either one of us had played with or against Pete Maravich. And I'm going to let you run with that first and we'll see what kind of stories we can come with the pistol.
Well, of course, we both played against Pete on six occasions. We were contemporaries, he at LSU and, of course, us at Kentucky. The interesting part about playing against Pete in LSU was a lot of the coaches in the SEC would try to come up with ways to defend Pete. You know, the box and chaser, the triangle and two. And you couldn't stop Pete from getting a shot off. He was so clever with the basketball. The best ball handler and passer I've ever seen. Magic Johnson.
Yeah, he was the first Magic Johnson.
Pete was the best. And so you couldn't keep him from getting a shot off. You could run all five guys at him. And he would get to a spot where he could get a shot. And so Coach Rupp's philosophy was completely the opposite. He said, we're going to guard Pete one-on-one, straight up. We're going to make sure that nobody else on the team beats us, and we'll live with whatever Pete gets. And poor Terry Mills and Jim Dinwiddie and Stan Key.
Mike Casey. They all chased him, right?
They had to guard Pete one-on-one. And I think if these stats aren't completely right, they're close. In the six times that we played against Pete head-to-head, Pete averaged 52 points a game. Had 63 one time his senior year. When we played him down at LSU, he had 63, but averaged 52 in the six head-to-head games. The closest they ever came to beating us was 9 points. And, of course, in those days, only the winner of the SEC, the regular season, we didn't have a tournament, only the winner of the regular season went on to the NCAA tournament. So Pete never played an NCAA game in his life because we won the SEC all 3 years we were there.
He did. The SEC did change a rule late, which allowed him to get to New York City. You remember that? Our junior year, they let one team go to the NIT from the league because the league had a rule or they just didn't want to send anybody to play in the NIT. So Tennessee goes to the NIT our junior year with Bill Justice and I think maybe Borwinkel was still there, played with the Bulls for 10 years. Yep. I mean, really good, talented team. The next year, LSU goes, and I think two teams went to the NIT.
Right.
To include Pete, who they ended up playing the championship game against Al McGuire's Marquette Warriors. And that was a big deal because New York City, at that point in time, was a mecca.
That was it.
Of basketball.
And Madison Pete, Square Garden.
Exactly. Pete gets back to go play in the old garden.
But Pete was a free spirit. There's no question about that. We got to know each other. We after our sophomore years, they had the Olympic tryouts, trying out for the 68 Olympic team that played in New Mexico City. And back then, they didn't take all, of course, pros couldn't play at all, but they got to the point where they took all college players. But that was the last year that they kind of had a formula that they went by. There were four guys from service ball. There were four guys from AAU, an NIA player, a junior college player. Thank goodness they took a junior college player because that was Spencer Haywood, who wound up being the star of the 68 Olympic team. Then in the 72 Olympics was when they started taking all college guys. And they only took four guys from the NCAA. Bill Hoskett.
Dayton's own Bill Hoskett.
Dayton's own. Charlie Scott, JoJo White, and a center from Houston who nobody's ever heard of, a guy by the name of Ken Spain. Those were the four guys for the NCAA that got to go to the 68 Olympics. But Pete and I and Case were in Albuquerque for the tryouts right the summer of after our sophomore year, and we got to know Pete a little bit. Pete was a wild hair boy. He thank goodness he in later days he found the Lord and became a devout Christian and died way too early. But Pete, as I said, he wasn't a great shooter. He just shot a lot. And the bad thing about that was, Mike, as you know, they had some talent on that team. The front line of that team, guys named Danny Hester, who played here with the Colonels, Apple Sanders and Fig Newton, all three of those guys played some time in the ABA. And so it wasn't like he was playing with a bunch of stiffs. But, you know, Press's goal was to make Pete the all-time leading scorer in the history of the NCAA basketball, and he did it.
You talked about how teams played different from the philosophy that Coach Rupp had. Ray Mears, terrific basketball coach. They played the 1-3-1. He played it many different variations of it, but that's what he played.
Just like Syracuse today.
Exactly. And he probably had as much success, Coach Mears did in the Vols, of limiting Pete. You weren't going to stop him because of the reasons that you mentioned. So, Pete was a show. People, I don't care where, if you were at Alabama, there was only two teams that could sell your arena out, Kentucky and Pete Maravich.
Yep.
That time. And they were always sold out. Pete was like a traveling road show. And we were much calmer, but we kind of fell into that.
and they played in a rodeo arena.
Yep. With a raised floor on the dirt.
Yeah. They would lay down 4x8 pieces of plywood for you to walk from the court to your locker room because the rest of the arena floor was dirt. And I'm sure since they had bulls and horses in there, dirt wasn't the only thing that was in that floor. But they would set the basketball court in the middle of the rodeo arena. And when Pete was a freshman, their varsity team was awful. When Pete was a freshman, they'd fill the place up for the freshman game. And then by the time the varsity game started, the rodeo arena was half empty because nobody wanted to stay and watch the varsity, but everybody was there to see Pete.
Do you remember they had birds flying around up at the top of that thing, if you remember right? And, of course, they would relieve themselves whenever they wanted to. But no, that was a, and it's still there. I go by, the bus goes by the football stadium and the Maravich Arena.
Right.
Coming in a certain way, you got to see that. It's I think it's part of the Ag, called the Ag Center.
Sure.
And it's still standing. Yeah. It's that was a wild time. That it sure was. We need to catch up with the Masters. We got a minute. I got to tell you a Pete story when we come back.
Okay.
You remember the back-to-back games we played with the Atlanta Hawks up in Frankfurt? Our one game was in Frankfurt, then we went back to Atlanta to play.
You're talking about exhibition games, our rookie year?
No, it was our third year.
Third year?
Yeah, third year. Started the third year. So I got a good Pete story involving another guy from Dayton in a roundabout way, Don May. So, all right, Process, let's catch up with the Masters. Let's see who's winning. They all are not out yet, but bring us up to speed, man. Well, talk to me for 20 seconds, Process.
All right, did you guys ever play Kareem? You ever play when he was Lou Alcindor back in the day?
No,
not in college.
Not in college, in the pros you did.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Unfortunately, I played him about 60 times in the NBA.
that sounds brutal. All right, here we go, Masters.
We'll ask Process. Welcome back to Sports Talk. Mike Pratt, Dan Issel, ESPN Louisville 680-1057. We were talking Pete Maravich.
Yep.
And what it was like to play against Pete and how people defended him and what a showman he was. And when he left college, became the all-time leading scorer in college basketball.
Do you know his senior year at LSU, he averaged 44 points a game?
Well, you averaged 33.
Well, I tell people
you had better. He had a better passer than you did. Huh?
I tell people that my senior year in college, I finished second in the nation in scoring, and I only lost the scoring title by 10 points a game. But can you imagine averaging 44? I mean, it would be unbelievable today if a college player got 44 points in a game, let alone average 44.
Well, we played an exhibition game the start of our third year up in Frankfurt in Atlanta to play the Hawks, because I think the previous year we had played the Knicks, the Bucks, and maybe that year we played the Bullets and the Hawks. So we had a combined charter, if you remember. And the reason I remember this is because a fellow Daytonian was involved. So we played, and they told me before the game, they said, look, we're going to play you this game, play Walt Simon in Atlanta. We're trying to make up our mind for the 10th spot on the team or whatever it was. I said, okay, I'll play in Frankfurt. So I have a good game. And knowing I'm not playing the next night in Atlanta, I get on the plane, the charter, and there's Don May from Dayton. Played at Dayton, terrific player, MVP of...
Was Donnie with the Hawks?
Yes. Okay. Yes. He and Pete were sitting together with some beers. And I get on and they go, hey, come on over here, sit by us, you know. And we got to talk and have a couple beers. So we flew to Atlanta. And then, of course, we got in our bus and they got in theirs. But Pete said to me, he said, look, so what are you doing tonight? Now, you know, it's like 11, 12 o'clock at night, okay? What am I doing tonight? I'm going back. Where are you staying? I said, downtown at the Marriott. And May's listening to this. You know, he's part of this conversation. And he says, I'll come pick you up. I'll take you out tonight. I said, well, you know, I might do that. I don't have to play
tomorrow.
That's
right. You had the next day off.
May shaking his head. Don't do it. Don't do it like that. So I end up out with Pete that night till about 3 or 4 in the morning and not having to play the next night. And
because if you had to play, you would have come home at 2.
Yeah, right. I'd have been home a little earlier. Okay, so later on in life, I'm up in Dayton and we're having dinner, a bunch of old basketball players, and Don May's one of them. And we had played golf that day, and we got to talking about Pete, and he was telling me a story. He was with Philadelphia, I think it was. He was traded to Atlanta, okay? So he goes to Atlanta, and he meets all the powers that be, and to include the owner. And the owner says, Donnie, you know, one of the reasons, not the only reason, Donnie, but one of the reasons you're here, I need somebody to take care of Pete. I said, you got to keep him out of trouble on the road. You know, you got to help us here because, you know, Pete likes playing the night league and the day league, both in one cycle. So that was and Donnie said, he said, man, that was hard. He yeah. said, that was the hardest thing in the world to try to keep him, you know, under check on the road.
Now, I told you he was a wild hare and he did some crazy things when I was with him. But thank goodness that he settled down and it's just a shame. I think he was 44 years old.
I think 41, 42.
That early?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, it was real young.
Yeah.
I mean, he was out. He had found the Lord. He was going around and presenting himself. And he was at a camp out in California someplace. And what they found out that one of his major arteries
was immature or hadn't fully developed.
And he had played all this basketball
yeah,
with it.
Yeah. You know, and passed away playing basketball.
Yeah.
He was, there was an organization in Colorado Springs called Focus on the Family, and he was playing a pickup game with the guy that ran Focus on the Family when he passed away.
In front of the campers?
No. It was just
privately.
Yeah, I think it was at lunchtime or something.
All right, since we're talking SEC basketball back in the day, and Pete Maravich and Ray Mears, what was the worst place, facility-wise and atmosphere-wise, that we played in your mind?
Well, we talked about LSU playing in the middle of a rodeo, but didn't Alabama have a really bad?
They
bad
had an spot? Old place, Foster Auditorium. It's still there. I've walked by it when I'm killing time walking
it
around.
It only there. Held like 3,000 or 4,000 people, didn't
yeah,
it?
Maybe five.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I don't remember a whole lot.
Oh, come on now, man.
I do remember this. We've talked about how superstitious Coach Rupp was. And you'll remember this. Our freshman year, we went down with the varsity and played a freshman game. And we stayed downtown in Knoxville at a place called the Knoll Hotel. Knoll Hotel. And by the time this had come by, it had become a flop house. I mean, there was nothing but bad stuff going on in the Knoll Hotel.
Yep.
And you got on the elevator, and they had an elevator operator. His name was Bertie.
They had
that old metal accordion door that the elevator stopped, and you had to pull that door before the elevator moved. And so our sophomore year, they had built a new Sheridan real close to campus. And we stayed at the Sheridan our sophomore year. And we played Tennessee early in the season. And I think it was the worst loss Coach Rupp ever had. Tennessee beat us by 20 or 30 points, didn't they?
About 22. And
was it?
They had showered us with oranges before the game, if you remember.
and it was and so that was early in our sophomore year. The next year we went to Knoxville. We were back at the Knoll Hotel. That's how superstitious Coach Rupp was.
See if you – Gator Alley was brutal because they had the lights, the open windows on one side, if you remember.
Yeah.
And the sun would come in, and part of the floor was shaded and part was with the light shining in. I thought that was a brutal place. But
we got beat pretty bad there our sophomore year.
Yes, we did. Neil Walk and that group. Yes, yes, we did. Probably the weirdest one I think we played in back then. The facilities were not. I mean, we had in Tennessee and Vandy had the three best facilities, but Auburn playing in that Quonset Hut.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a Quonset Hut. Yeah. You remember that when you were sophomores?
But they were in the process of building a new place, I think.
It didn't help that game.
but our junior or senior year, we were in their brand new building.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
But I remember, you get spoiled by playing in the Coliseum or even going to Tennessee. We showed up. We went down there and we showed up, and you're playing in a Quonset Hut. And you had seen those before, either pictures of or whatnot. But we're in there playing. And you remember the locker room?
No.
Oh, man. They had pegs in the wall. We had to hang our coats up. And we dressed in the hotel and went back to the hotel and showered after the game.
Yeah.
And then went to the plane.
We used to do that a lot in the early days of the ABA because the arenas we played in were so bad.
Yep.
Some of them didn't even have hot water in the locker rooms. And we couldn't afford buses, so we'd take four or five taxis from the hotel to the arena. And on a lot of occasions, we would put on our uniforms, put on our sweats, put on our coat, jump in the taxi, and go play the game and come back to the hotel to take a shower.
Kind of like playing at Quonset Hut, okay?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
All right, Dan, we've wrapped up our first week, man. It's been a lot of fun.
Have a great weekend. I'm going to Keeneland.
Yeah, and I expect, should I give you my $100 now or later?
Yeah, later.
Well, we will see everybody on Monday morning, 10 to 12, right here on ESPN Louisville, 680-1057. Dan Issel, Mike Pratt.
Exmark makes the mowers that care for the lawns that set the stage for the backyard life. As the commercial mowers more landscape pros trust, Exmark mowers get you on and off the lawn without compromising cut quality, comfort, or reliability. Exmark, official mowers of the backyard life, starting at $29.99. Learn about the available finance offers and check them out today at The Mower Shop, 7400 Preston Highway, Louisville, Kentucky, 502-969-6433.
Make your life better with a new job at UPS. Join Team Louisville as a warehouse worker, earn $14.50 per hour plus a $175 weekly bonus for some shifts. Search and apply now at upsjobs.com/Louisville. That's upsjobs.com/Louisville.
Bet River Sportsbook has supercharged its iOS app. Download the update today from the Apple App Store and see the difference for yourself. Must be 21 or over to play. Playable only in Indiana. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-9-WITH-IT.